From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In Paris today, one day after the landslide victory of French President-elect Emmanuel Macron, protesters demonstrated against labor law reforms that Macron supported when he was a minister in the government of François Hollande. Reforms like opening stores on Sunday and later at night during the week, which workers opposed. For his part, Macron attended a solemn ceremony today at the Arc de Triomphe to commemorate the 72nd anniversary of the end of World War II. He also started to lay the groundwork for his transition to power, which will be interesting. Macron soundly defeated the far-right candidate Marine Le Pen with 66% of the vote in yesterday's election. But turnout was lower than normal, a sign that voters weren't happy with either choice. And Macron ran as an independent. He formed a movement, but not a formal party. And he still has to win over other party members to win seats in parliament. NPR's Frank Langfitt joins us from Paris. Frank, first of all, what is the overall feeling there today?
Well, it kind of depends on where you are. I mean, here in Paris, you know, this is a cosmopolitan global city. They like Emmanuel Macron. You know, he's one of their own. He's young. He's urbane, a fresh face, 39 years old, and someone who's very open to Europe and integration in Europe and open to the world. So they like him a lot. Where I was yesterday, totally different story. I was up in the north. This is Le Pen country. We're talking about former coal towns. We're talking about factory towns where the factories have closed, hard hit by economic globalization. They're very disappointed. And there's a fear up there that Macron is not going to make this country safer. Fighting terrorism has not been a strong part of his platform. And they actually think that Marine Le Pen may have a chance in 5 years if Macron struggles and has problems.
For her to run again. Well, meantime, talk about what he has to do to get a government in place. He's never held elected office. He was appointed in Hollande's administration. He was a minister. But there are these legislative elections next month. Tell us how that works.
Well, it's going to be challenging and going to be fascinating. His party, it will become a party at some point. I guess we're close to that. Is going to be fielding candidates in all 577 constituencies. I was talking to Charles Litchfield. He's an analyst with Eurasia Group, the political risk consultancy. And he says usually what happens is a president kind of gets an electoral bump here in France based on political tradition and the goodwill of voters. Here's how Charles put it.
The French electorate has tended to provide presidents with a majority. There's a feeling that if you've elected a president, you might as well allow them to govern.
But Litchfield doesn't think Macron is actually going to win a clear majority. He's probably going to need to govern in a coalition, perhaps with moderate members of the center-right Republican Party. So that's going to be very tricky. That, again, is coming up in June. And people will be watching that very closely because even though Macron had a big victory last night, his supporters are very excited about it. He now has to try to govern, and then he's going to have to deliver.
And what about Le Pen? You mentioned her supporters hope she runs again, but that's in a few years. What does she do?
Well, I mean, what she tries to do is exactly what Macron was trying to do, and that is win as many seats in parliament as she can. Last night, when she was conceding defeat, she said that her plan was for her National Front party to be the second party in France and to oppose the main opposition to Emmanuel Macron. So from listening to her, she doesn't think this is over at all, and she's going to try to fight him on these issues, and we'll see how she does.
And just broadly, we talked about in France, but broadly, can you feel a sigh of relief from other countries? Because she was adamant that she was anti-European Union and was going to look for the Frexit, you know, for France to leave.
Indeed. I think the response in Brussels, people are very relieved there because the feeling, and this is, I think, is absolutely true. It was one thing to have the United Kingdom leave the European Union, which the UK is in the process of doing, but to lose France would have actually probably destroyed the EU. Nobody thought that they could survive without France. So this is a relief. And I think I was talking to someone today who was saying, you know, 2016, a very, very bad year for the European Union with the Brexit vote. This looking like a little bit of a better year. You saw Geert Wilders, a far-right anti-EU candidate in the Netherlands. I covered that election earlier this year. He did not win. And now we're seeing Marine Le Pen losing badly here in France.
That's NPR's Frank Langfitt in Paris. Frank, thank you.
Happy to do it, Robin.
Well, a quick note, world leaders are weighing in on the Macron win. President Trump tweeted congratulations to Emmanuel Macron on his big win. This was yesterday. As the next president of France, I look very much forward to working with him. British Prime Minister Theresa May congratulated Macron as well, issuing a statement that France is one of our closest allies, and we look forward to working with the new president on a wide range of shared priorities. For German Chancellor Angela Merkel, one of those shared priorities is to promote European stability. She told reporters today that Macron ran a courageous pro-European campaign, stands for openness to the world, and is committed decisively to a social market economy. Even Russian President Vladimir Putin, whom Macron has criticized and is thought to have tried to influence the French election, released a statement that overcoming mutual distrust and joining efforts to ensure international stability and security is especially important.
Well, in Texas, Governor Greg Abbott made a surprise appearance on Facebook Live last night and signed into law a bill that establishes criminal and civil penalties for government entities and law enforcement agencies that don't comply with federal immigration laws and detention requests. In short, it's a ban on sanctuary cities. The ACLU of Texas calls the new law a racist and wrong-headed piece of legislation. It goes into effect on September 1st. The law is seen as a reaction to moves by a number of cities and institutions that offer a safe haven to people in the country illegally, and that includes some school districts in California. From Here and Now contributor KQED, Anna Tentakulis reports from Sacramento. Tanto
tiempo disfrutamos. This is Liz Villanueva's fourth period Spanish class at Luther Burbank High School in Sacramento. Most of her students are Latino. She punches up some music to get kids thinking about the language.
I think language is power. That's what I try to teach my students. You know, when you are able to use the language and you're able to make connections with anybody, it's a vehicle that transports you. It takes you to different routes.
Villanueva grew up in Mexico and is now a U.S. citizen. But her mom crossed illegally, which is why she helps undocumented families find immigration attorneys. Villanueva says once President Donald Trump took office and threatened to ramp up deportations, one of her attorney friends said to expect even more families to get torn apart. She says that broke her heart.
And when he was leaving, he told me, Liz, be strong. Be strong for them. They have you. That's why I began to bring more resources.
And that's why she was thankful when the Sacramento Unified School District declared itself as a safe haven. That means schools here will not cooperate with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE. California school districts are taking the lead when it comes to making this pledge. Roughly 60 have adopted resolutions. And now school districts in other states, including Michigan, Alabama, and Wisconsin, are following suit. But teachers and principals say they can only do so much. And parents say they worry about what might happen before or after the school bell rings.
Take this after-school sports event, track and field. There's a bunch of kids. The stadium is packed. What if federal immigration officials came onto this field?
What we know is that we only have control over our space and the confines of our school day.
Jesse Ryan is Sacramento Unified's school board vice president.
And that means having very uncomfortable conversations about, in worst-case scenarios, having families deported and how we support the remaining children.
A recent high-profile case in Los Angeles underscores that, when ICE arrested an undocumented father taking his daughter to school.
United, we'll never be divided. We'll never be divided.
At a contentious town hall forum in Sacramento, ICE acting director Tom Homan maintained that the agency's top priority is still deporting undocumented immigrants with criminal histories. Still, he knows families are keeping kids home out of fear.
Listen to me now. I don't want children not going to school.
He told the angry crowd that his department has a policy of sensitive locations, like schools. But he said ICE agents can still legally go on campus if they have orders to arrest someone.
I understand immigration enforcement is a very emotional topic. I get that. But we're law enforcement officers to take a solemn oath to enforce the laws of this country, and that's what we're going to do.
But organizations like the ACLU say schools have legal rights when it comes to dealing with ICE. Federal immigration agents must have a warrant to pull a student or parent from school, or have a subpoena if they want student information. But many school officials across California don't know that. Several districts recently were found to have collected information about the legal status of their students, which is against the law. For its part, Sacramento Unified is doing what it can to ease fears, and that means a lot to 15-year-old Felix. He was born here, but most of his family is undocumented.
Even if something bad were to happen, I know that if I were to come here, my teachers would support me and they would help me through it.
Pocket-sized pamphlets have been sent home spelling out the rights of immigrant families, and school officials are holding confidential meetings with parents to encourage them to send their children to school. For Here and Now, I'm Anna Tintopoulos in Sacramento.
We're going to spend some time this week talking about privatization in America. Privatization of education, defense, infrastructure, our digital lives, where it's worked well and where it hasn't. To start us off, we're joined by Donald Cohen and Sherzad Habibi of the research and advocacy group In the Public Interest. Hello to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Well, privatization is ubiquitous today, but how did we get here? Who came up with the idea of privatization? And I'll start with you, Donald Cohen.
Well, the idea came from a reaction by conservative ideological theorists and strategists in reaction to the New Deal, to the expansion of government services and the role of government in our society. They actually redefined what governments all over the country already did, and that's lots of contracting for things. But they turned it into an ideological struggle. And what conservatives now come into government to do to privatize or outsource services.
So it was political more than economic, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If you look at some of the writings of folks from the Heritage Foundation and other sort of conservative think tanks in the 70s and 80s who wanted to reduce the role of government, they want government to be, you know, you get what you pay for and you don't pay for what you don't use. And so they created a political project that was intended strategically, and they're very clear about this, to split constituencies because most people actually liked government services and wanted government services. So they needed to split those constituencies that supported government programs from the question of who delivers those services.
The person that I think a lot of people associate with privatization even today is President Ronald Reagan, who was a big champion of it. In 1987, he signed an executive order creating a commission on privatization. But long before that, he championed the private sector. Here he is in a 1964 speech, 2 years before he was elected governor of California.
A government can't control the economy without controlling people. And they know when a government sets out to do that, it must use force and coercion to achieve its purpose. They also knew, those founding fathers, that outside of its legitimate functions, government does nothing as well or as economically as the private sector of the economy.
How responsible was Reagan for launching this wave of privatization in America?
He played a big role in the ideological push to privatize and outsource American public services. He actually didn't do that much implementation. He was up against a Democratic Congress. He signed the executive order. He pushed hard. But in the end, it really fell to President Clinton to implement.
Which is interesting because he obviously was a Democrat.
Right. Well, he was a Democrat that came in 1992 and, you know, his famous quote, the era of big government's over, which speaks to Reagan's sort of ideological influence that, you know, the attack on government had succeeded and people were just, you know, people didn't trust government anymore. But what Clinton did was actually make it happen. You know, he had asked Vice President Gore to lead a commission on reinventing government. And that's all well and good. You should always do better and you should always reinvent. But he did – two things came out of that were very important. First, Clinton told Gore and told the – made a decision in the administration to reduce the federal employment by 100,000 jobs. The problem with that is the work still needs to happen. People still count on the services. So the result is the beginning of a massive increase in the number of contractors. The second thing that came out of the Gore program and President Clinton's language was really about redefining who we are, from citizens to consumers. where we were now customers of public services. We were no longer citizens with rights and responsibilities. And I can't overestimate the significance of that. Redefining who we are and what we do as a nation, as participants, is really important. We aren't just consumers. It's in my interest for every child to be educated, for my interest for workers in another part of the country to not be poisoned on the job, and for there to be a middle class. It's in all of our interests, and those are the things that governments do.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about privatization in America with Donald Cohen and Sherzad Habibi from the group In the Public Interest. And Sherzad Habibi, let me bring you in. Where are we seeing privatization today in this country more than we've ever seen in the past?
So really, there is privatization and contracting going on in all sectors of government, everything from education to health and human services to our physical infrastructure, to our criminal justice system, our water systems. So we're really seeing corporations seeing these public services and public assets as potential moneymakers. There's almost $2 trillion worth of contracts on the local, state, and federal levels of government combined every year. And some of those contracts are done well, and some of them are not. So last year, we looked at a sample of cities that had contracted out their trash collection. And some of them were done well. Some of them had strong language regarding things like the city's ability to manage the contract, to oversee and hold the contractor accountable. There were provisions that ensured workforce stability. And those were the contracts that were more successful and allowed the city to be able to quickly correct problems, when they cropped up.
Well, let me bring up an example, and I think that this may be reflective of something that some of our listeners, as they hear both of you speak, are thinking, which is, I remember two construction projects going on at the same time. One was a bus station in the middle of a big intersection, and one was a huge hotel that they were building right across the street from the bus station. The bus station was being done by the city or by the government. The hotel was being done by a private organization. The hotel was finished faster than the bus stop. I think a lot of people look at that and they say the private companies can do things quicker.
One thing to note, one thing to a bus station, another thing for talking about, and we were, you know, what Cher was referring in infrastructure is roads and bridges and big projects. All of those things are built by the private sector. So we contract for all, you know, every major piece of infrastructure is built by the private sector. So the issue, of course, is who's in control of it, right? We believe that government needs to be as good as it, better than the private sector because it's tax money and it's our money and it's precious and limited. But that's different than handing over control to private sector and we'll hire them to build it and they'll do a good job or not good job depending on the, how the standards are set up. But we also give it to them. We privatize it and that's where that's where really awful things have happened.
Awful things like what? What is so scary about privatization in your view?
Yeah, so there are a lot of examples, of contracts that don't maintain that public control, that don't have those strong standards. In 2008, the city of Chicago signed a 75-year contract with a consortium of companies that included Morgan Stanley to run the city's 36,000 parking meters. And the contract included a compensation clause that required the city to pay financial penalties to the private companies if events occurred that threatened their profits. So as a result, the city has to pay the private companies for lost revenue resulting from very standard policy and planning decisions that remove a parking meter from the system.
Like a parade or something like that.
Exactly. So creation of new bike lanes, street fairs, road construction. And what's really important to note is this is for the life of the 75-year contract. So this is really limiting what policymakers can do generations into the future.
Now, we have a president now who was a private businessman. He has railed against big government. What are you expecting from President Trump on the issue of privatization? Do you expect a lot of things that right now are public to become private?
One area that we're concerned about is around prison privatization and privatization of immigration detention. There has been a lot of momentum in the Trump administration to increase the number of beds within the immigration detention system. And what that means is contracting out with for-profit companies. The two largest of companies are publicly traded companies, Geo Group and CoreCivic. These are companies that have horrible track record. There was one prison in Idaho that was so violent that it became known as the Gladiator School, and it was incredibly mismanaged and understaffed. And in the immigration detention facilities where there's children and families, there's documentation of psychologically damaging conditions, with children being subjected to harsh living conditions, inedible food, wrong dosages of medications, and other horrific conditions.
Donald Cohen?
President Trump's cabinet and appointees are really sort of a roadmap to privatize all sorts of things. They'd like to privatize Medicaid. They're certainly trying to do that in the current health care bill. Give states the opportunity to do that. Education, sort of across the board in every department. And I'm pretty convinced what will happen from my research on the Clinton administration, every other administration, is maybe it's Jared Kushner, but they're going to go to every department in the federal level and say, what can you outsource? In a lot of places, the federal government is just a bank, right? It gives monies to states and locals to do X or Y or build a road or what have you. I wouldn't be surprised if they condition some of those grants and loans and things on outsourcing and privatization.
That's Donald Cohen and Sherzad Habibi with the research and advocacy group In the Public Interest, starting off our series on privatization in America. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And you may not have heard of the Sinclair Broadcast Group, but there's a good chance you watch one of its TV stations. Sinclair controls around a quarter of the local stations across the country, and it soon could own more. In a deal announced today, Sinclair is buying Tribune Media for $4 billion. Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, joins us from New York. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Robin.
Now, Sinclair is said to have a conservative political agenda. We'll take that up, but it is the largest local station owner in the country. What would this deal do to its reach?
So most of Sinclair's stations are in smaller markets like Buffalo and Milwaukee. And with this deal, they will add stations in very big, attractive media markets like New York, Chicago, and Miami. And that should really help strengthen their hand when it comes to negotiating with both cable and satellite TV distributors who pay a fee to air their stations, but as well as with major broadcast networks who provide Sinclair with their content for the local stations.
Well, and talk about the climate at the FCC that has recently changed as President Trump has picked someone new to run the FCC that might make this deal even more important.
Right. So companies are only allowed to own TV stations that reach no more than 39% of U.S. households. And when calculating how many households a company reaches, there used to be what was known as a UHF discount, because stations that broadcast on UHF or ultra-high frequencies don't have as far of a reach as VHF channels. Mm-hmm. And that discount was eliminated during the Obama administration. In other words, they used to only have to count about half of the area that these channels served. But media companies had lobbied to reinstate that so-called discount. And the new FCC chairman did exactly that. Now, it's kind of an antiquated thing because TV is distributed digitally now. Mm-hmm. So there is likely possibly going to be a challenge to this in court.
Well, but in the meantime, stations want to gobble up other companies want to gobble up other stations. Get to Sinclair's owners. It was Sinclair founded by the Smith family. David D. Smith is the longtime chair. The company has donated mostly to Republican causes. They also syndicate conservative commentary to their stations. And analysts are saying that this move, gobbling up Tribune, puts pressure on 21st Century Fox, which also has a conservative bent and had considered bidding on Tribune, but didn't. So, and Fox News right now is also dealing with a lot of scandals. What does this move by Sinclair mean for Fox?
So remember that local TV stations that are affiliated with a major network like Fox aren't necessarily owned by that network. Right. They're owned by companies like Sinclair. So after this deal, Sinclair will add 16 more Fox stations. It already owns a bunch and will basically control about 28% of the nation's Fox affiliate stations. So that gives it a very strong negotiating hand with Fox. And it obviously, you know, raises a lot of sort of gossip and speculation about whether they could possibly be thinking about a rival to Fox News. You know, obviously with Bill O'Reilly out and Roger Ailes and Bill Shine all gone from Fox, these were really the, you know, some of the founding people that made Fox what it is. There's all sorts of speculation that Sinclair could be up to something else, but there was no indication from today's announcement that they were planning any sort of Fox News competition.
Okay, but people who care about such things will keep an eye on that. Michael Regan, senior editor, Bloomberg News. Michael, thanks as always.
Thank you, Remen.
Presidents make history, but what if they don't know their history? That's a question that's come up after some comments from President Trump, most recently about President Andrew Jackson. Here he is on Sirius XM Radio.
I mean, had Andrew Jackson been a little bit later, you wouldn't have had the Civil War. He was a very tough person, but he had a big heart, and he was really angry that he saw what was happening with regard to the Civil War. He said, there's no reason for this.
Trump has often cited the populist Jackson as a role model. Jackson died in 1845. The Civil War started in 1861. And Jackson was a slave-holding plantation owner, so there are doubts about whether he could have prevented a war that wound up ending slavery. Joining us now is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. He's back with us once again. Hi, Julian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. And first of all, what about those comments about Andrew Jackson and the Civil War? Does history back up what President Trump said at all?
I think a lot of historians didn't agree with what he said, both from the notion that he necessarily had a big heart, but more importantly, that he would have been able or willing to end or prevent the Civil War from happening. It obviously happens after his death. And I think most historians agree with the overall power of the problem of slavery in dividing this nation.
And do you think that the reason President Trump said that is because he doesn't understand the history or he got it wrong? Or what do you think was going on there?
Well, some of it might be that he doesn't understand it. Some of it might be he heard bits and pieces about discussions of President Jackson and then repeated them out of context. Part of it is he often turns to Andrew Jackson not to make a point about history but to make a symbolic political point today, using him as a kind of symbol of conservative populism that he himself wants to champion and also as a symbol of a tough leader. In his account of the Civil War, a president who was just tough enough and who knew how to make things happen could end this horrific event that happened in our nation's history. And he wants to make the argument, I think, that he could do the same kind of thing or the same kind of magic that he imagines Andrew Jackson would have been able to do.
And when you say it like that, it sounds like you're saying Jackson did not do something so magical. I mean, how does he stack up as a president in your view?
Well, certainly with many issues like the treatment of Native Americans, he doesn't rank very well. And many people have a very different vision of Andrew Jackson, not just the populist, but someone who was quite repressive. And this is a part, obviously, of Jackson as well as his slaveholding past that is something very troubling to historians, as is the idea that the Civil War shouldn't have happened necessarily, meaning in the end, one historian said if you view this as a war of liberation that ends this horrendous institution that was part of this country, then the claims by President Trump are even more troubling.
Let's listen to another example of President Trump talking history. Here he is in February at an event celebrating Black History Month.
I am very proud now that we have a museum in the National Mall where people can learn about Reverend King, so many other things. Frederick Douglass is an example of somebody who's done an amazing job and is being recognized more and more, I notice. Harriet Tubman, Rosa Parks, and millions more black Americans who made America what it is today. Big impact.
So some people interpreted those comments about Frederick Douglass as the president seeming to imply that Douglass, the black abolitionist who died in 1895, was still alive, or at least that he was just now being recognized. What did you make of that one?
Well, I don't want to read too much into everything he says, right, because he is very loose with words. And so it could have been that what it sounds like he's saying is not what he meant to say. I think the reason it troubles many people is there's a question of how seriously he takes the history of many important issues in our country, whether it's the history of the presidency, the position he now holds, or the history of race relations and figures such as Douglass. And so it's not simply does he know who someone is or when they lived, but does he even care? And are there certain issues that he just cares less than others? I think that's why some of these comments often trigger this kind of concern more than they might with other presidents in either party we've had in the past.
Well, how important is it for a president to really know his history?
Well, it's important. Obviously, you don't want presidents frequently making big mistakes about the kinds of issues that we learn about in school. I think it's also fair to say that presidents will make mistakes, and they'll make statements that often are inaccurate or incorrect, and we shouldn't argue this is necessarily disastrous. So I think a lot of this is the context of the person saying it. If a president seems to have a sense of this country and what made this country and makes one mistake, I don't think everyone will necessarily jump on them, as opposed to a president who doesn't seem to have much deep interest in those issues, then these mistakes are magnified.
To be fair here, let's go back into the vault and listen to some previous presidents saying some things about history that have been called into question. This is President Obama when he was running for president. Back in 2008, he was in an event for veterans.
I had a uncle who was one of the who was part of the first American troops to go into Auschwitz and liberate the concentration camps.
Now, Obama was called out on this because it was Soviet troops who liberated Auschwitz. But I wonder if there are other examples that you can think of when it comes to presidents or presidential candidates getting history wrong or embellishing it.
Sure. There were a lot of famous quotations from Ronald Reagan, who would sometimes mix things up about World War II, for example, that he had seen in films, and talk about them as if they happened in his own life. Gerald Ford made one of the famous gaffes in presidential debates in 1976 against Jimmy Carter when he said there's no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe. He meant to say something different, but it sounded like he didn't really understand the history of the Cold War, and that was very costly politically.
Now, presidents can talk about history. They also are every day making history, and I want to get your thoughts on President Trump, because there's already an ad campaign supporting his reelection. Let's listen to a part of it.
Donald Trump, sworn in as president 100 days ago. America has rarely seen such success. A respected Supreme Court justice, confirmed.
Companies and he goes on and on listing various accomplishments, including a tax plan that hasn't even been passed yet, but he's saying that that's one of them. What are your thoughts on President Trump's first 100 days, or now more than 100 days, and the claims that he makes that America has rarely seen such success?
Well, if you look at legislation, it's hard to agree with his statement. It's just not the case that he's one of our most successful presidents in the first 100 days. He doesn't have major legislation to speak of, and his major initiative, healthcare, failed the first round. His biggest success was either the confirmation of a Supreme Court justice, which is significant, and most of what he's done has been using executive power. But in terms of legislation, where we usually measure presidents since FDR, he certainly doesn't come out with a very voluminous record. I would say the 100 days isn't necessarily the best measure of a president. If he does well in the next 50 days or the next 100 days, I think down the line, that's what we'll be talking about. But this is an example of where he's trying to spin the history and spin his own presidencies in ways that often contradict what we're watching right in front of us.
Is it unusual for him to be doing this so early in his first term, to be running a re-election ad?
It is odd to do it so explicitly. Presidents are always thinking about politics. They're making speeches. They're often pushing for certain legislation with elections in mind. But President Trump is basically starting his campaign for 2020 not that far after this presidency has begun. So it's partly him and partly an acceleration and intensification of the ongoing campaigns that we now live with.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Americans eat 2 billion pounds of avocados a year. That's a lot of guacamole. Most of the fruit comes from Mexico. Only about 10% is grown in California. But researchers in California's Central Valley Agricultural Region are breeding avocado trees they hope will grow well there and make California a bigger player in the industry. Ezra David Romero of Valley Public Radio reports.
Customers love the guacamole served tableside at El Torito in downtown Fresno so much that about half of them order it. Daniel Avalos is the general manager there. He and I just ordered some guac. For $10, the appetizer is created on a platter in front of us.
She cut the avocados in half, and then she's getting the pulp out of the avocado, putting it on the molcajete. That's where we smash the avocado and mix it with veggies.
Avalos says the restaurant goes through about 500 avocados a week, and when they added tableside guacamole to their menu in the 80s, it quickly became a hit.
It's really good.
Really good.
Most of the avocados he buys are from out of the country, but he wishes California avocados were available more often.
California avocados, they're the best in the world, but, you know, we don't have them all year long.
One avocado researcher wants to change that. Mary Lou Arpaia is on a mission to find an avocado tree that can withstand the Central Valley's frosty winters and hot summers. Currently, most avocados in the state are grown in Southern California. Since 1996, Arpaia's bred avocado trees across the state for the University of California. On less than 5 acres at a citrus research center in Lemon Cove in Central California, Arpaia thinks she's found 3 varieties that can do just that.
There's a void of California fruit on the market in the months of November, December, and actually early January. So if we can find different selections that maybe are unique, that fit into that window, then we help the entire California avocado industry.
Most of the avocados Americans eat are a variety called Hass. The Hass variety doesn't grow well in the Central Valley. California doesn't grow enough avocados to compete with a large amount coming in from foreign markets. The goal is to breed varieties that aren't super tall, can be planted close to each other, and have a high yield. One type Arpaia and her colleague Eric Folk are recommending to growers has all these traits. It's called Gem and is already sold at nurseries. Arpaia didn't breed it, but they made the decision to recommend that the university patent and release it.
This is Gem. You can see it's sort of a little more oval or egg-shaped than Hass. It has the speckling on the skin, and this will, as it ripens, it'll turn dark, and a lot of times this sort of speckled lenticels will get a kind of yellow golden colored.
Gem is actually the great-granddaughter of Hass. The second type is nicknamed Lunchbox for its small size. The third has no name yet, but Arpaia and Folk think it holds promise.
Lunchbox, that one peels nice, but I mean this one just falls out of the skin. Like you just open it up and comes right out, and the skin's
It makes wonderful guacamole. I found just with a non-replicated test in my refrigerator, the fruit doesn't brown.
Arpaia says both of these varieties should be on the market within a year or two. That's good news for California avocado growers who want options.
I want our avocado varieties to be in season for more than 1 week, but I want it where you can say, oh, you know, it's July, it's time to pick this variety.
The premium supermarket chains across the country really want California avocados year-round. They recognize California fruit is much higher quality than the competitive fruit that's coming in from overseas.
That's Tim Spann. He's the research program director at the California Avocado Commission. The industry once funded the UC avocado research, but pulled most of their funding a few years ago to focus on pests harming avocado trees. Now he says the commission is thinking of reversing course.
Recently, some growers are investing in some new varieties, and we're getting to have some fairly significant acreage and production. We are currently talking about how to reinvest in the program.
John Stearns is one of the few avocado farmers in the Central Valley. He grows 25 acres of mainly Hass avocados on a hill and says the incline helps keep the trees warm in the winter.
In the summertime, we do some cooling techniques with our emitters and some foggers and stuff like that to help cool when it gets really hot, you know, over 105 degrees.
He says he'd love to get his hands on avocado varieties that do well in the valley.
If they could come up with a variety that's similar to the Hass that we could plant, you know, down at ground level instead of having it on the hills, I'm sure a lot of people would plant them.
And it's not just avocado farmers that are interested in the new varieties. California citrus growers are looking for alternative crops thanks to the looming threat to their business. It's a disease called Wonglongbing carried by tiny bugs that decimated the citrus industry in Florida and has made its way to Southern California. Citrus growers are hoping scientists will come up with resistant citrus varieties. But if the disease reaches the Central Valley, farmers may turn to growing avocados if the University Research Center's findings prove fruitful. For Here Now, I'm Ezra David Romero.
How important are avocados? When someone lifted our colleague Lynn Jolliker's from the kitchen, it was seen as a major offense. Don't mess with someone's avocado.
I love how he used the term fruitful.
Yes.
Right at the end there.
We got that.
Well, this afternoon on All Things Considered, we'll take a closer look at one of the environmental programs that President Trump wants to eliminate. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.